You're listening to the In the Money Players Podcast. Hello and welcome to the In the Money Players Podcast. I'm your host, Peter Thomas Fornital, back with you for show number 13. It is Tuesday, February 5th. Happy Chinese New Year. Alternate side of the street parking suspended makes my Tuesday less stressful. I always like that. Love Chinese New Year. Great holiday. Wish I could be there at a parade somewhere along the line. Instead, I'm in the Brooklyn bunker grinding away, working on all kinds of stuff, trying to clear the decks ahead of NHC weekend. I will be heading out to Las Vegas on Friday. We will be publishing a special episode of the In the Money Players Podcast. Be on the lookout for that. But first, we have a fantastic show for you today. Pat Cummings of the Thoroughbred Idea Foundation is here to talk about some really exciting stuff racing can potentially do, not just to survive in the new sports betting world, but to thrive. That's coming up a little bit later. Also, a visitor we've been wanting to have forever, more or less. He's so busy, I always feel bad bothering him, but we allowed it to happen this time. Steve Bick is going to be coming by. We're going to be talking about the NHC and his role out there. Going to be a lot of fun. But first, I want to bring in the co-host. He's riding high, folks. National TV over the weekend, getting to go to his favorite place, Santa Anita, even if the weather wasn't so good. But right now, he's back on the planet Texas. He's competing in the NHC this weekend, looking for another title. He has a tour championship under his belt. He once finished with two entries in the top 10 out there, looking to win the whole thing. I'm talking about the People's Champion, Jonathan Kinchin. What's up, my man?
PTF, I've got a confession for you.
Ooh, I like that.
And a story for the people. So we were out in Louisville for the Breeders' Cup, and Pete and I were doing Equestricon, and we had a little bit of a break, and Pete wanted to get a coffee. I'm new to the coffee world. I'm not really a midday coffee guy. It's kind of the morning version. It needs to have chocolate in it. I know. I'm working on it. We walk by two Starbucks, and I'm like, Pete, what are we doing? And Pete wants to go to some coffee shop he saw on Yelp that has good coffee. And my confession is that at that moment, I wanted to punch you in the face. I really did. I was tired. My feet were hurting. I was probably overdressed. It was probably warmer than I wanted it to be or colder than I wanted it to be. I don't remember. I didn't want to walk. I admit to you now that there is a difference between regular Starbucks coffee and coffee that you can get from a place that takes a little bit more pride. I went out of my way this morning to get a little bit more prideful coffee. And so to this, I owe you an apology. And next time, I'll be a better walking partner when we're trying to find some good stuff.
JK, even for you, this is a really elaborate excuse for why you were late to the show today. But I do appreciate it. I'll put in a quick plug, actually. We got a couple of tips. Our buddy David Crone tipped us on Please and Thank You and Heine Brothers Coffee in Louisville. And I wanted to seek them both out. And they were both very good, especially Please and Thank You. Those were good tips. Some of the many good tips we received over Breeders' Cup weekend. But not nearly as good, JK, as a certain tip we received this past weekend. I'll let you tell the story.
First of all, I was starting to panic on the show, on the Fox Sports Saturday at the races. I was panicking because I had not given a winner yet. And I'm like, that's like my job to be there, is to like, you know, be the horse player guy that's going to give some insight. And I just was whiffing and whiffing and whiffing and whiffing. And then finally I hit the late pick three, quote unquote, late pick three, and gave out the winner of the Martha Washington. I think the horse's name was Power Gal. It was a Japanese bred horse that Mark Cassie had for the Barbers. And then I gave out Mucho Gusto, who was my best bet of the day. But before everyone starts yelling at me about that, give me a second here. Well, first of all, he was 3-5 and he won, so he was the best bet. Second of all, I made those plays earlier in the morning when Nolo Contesto was still in, the six horse was in. So my thought was Nolo Contesto was going to take money and also Gunmetal Gray. And you get closer to even money on Mucho Gusto. I felt like that was value. They late scratched the horse after I already turned in my play, whatever. I still liked the horse as a single. He won. And then 20-1, first time gelding at Oaklawn Park. Took the pressure off. I felt like I had probably had a positive ROI at that point. It was a lot of fun. The show was a lot of fun. It's fast and furious, man. Like, I'll be better next time when I'm more prepared. It was like they're in your ear, they're yelling, and it's like I was expecting what happened at Saratoga this summer, which was like these long breaks in between races. But this was like bang, bang, prices. What did you think of that race? Who's up coming up next? Post parade here, boom, bang, and like, is the camera on me? And it was a new thing for me. But once I've gone through it now, I think I'll do better on the other end.
I thought you were great. And I do think you have the potential to even be better. I was super impressed with the overall quality of the broadcast. So many talented people on there. It came together really well. And I enjoyed the range of personalities and opinions. They've put a terrific team together. And I think it's great that you're a part of it, man. You look good up there. And you've given out some winners, which is great. But let me tell you, that wasn't the tip I was referring to from the weekend, JK. We had a tip regarding the Super Bowl, a certain prop bet at the Super Bowl that I wanted you to tell the story of.
Oh, of course. Of course. I took all the credit for the tip. Yes. Yeah, so the person who gave us the tip, we'll refer to him as quote unquote Quincy Jones, right? Well, that'll be his name for the story. Quincy was involved in a pick six. We played a pick six together, all of us, and Quincy was involved. We got knocked out of the pick six, and he sent the group a message. He said, bet the over on the national anthem tomorrow. I have talked to Quincy Jones a number of times over beverages. He's like undefeated in the national anthems in like the last 5 or 6 years. He gets inside information on a rehearsal. Now, what happens...
This has become a whole big story, by the way. I'll link the blog to this idea of inside information and rehearsals. And you are leaving out the fact that one of the country singers got nervous and sped it up, and it went under even though it was supposed to go over. But other than that, he's something like 9-1 in the last decade.
He lets us know, and he's telling everyone, we're passing it along. We're telling everyone to look at their local bookie or whoever they can get a bet down with to see if they can find the action on the national anthem. Boy, was he right. He told us 2 minutes and 2 seconds, and it was like 2 minutes, 1 second, and like, you know, whatever, you know, 45 tenths. It was awesome. It was the most gratifying experience. I had the stopwatch out. We're all sitting here. My son was with me. We were watching the national anthem and counting, and it was phenomenal. It was a lot of fun. One of the most fun Super Bowl wagers I've ever had.
It was certainly more entertaining than the game, I'll say that much. But I just thought from a pure degeneracy point of view, the look that Susan gave me as we're late to our Super Bowl party, riding in the car, I've got the Westwood One broadcast on, I've got the stopwatch out, and she's just looking at me like watching me text you back and forth, the encouraging remarks, etc. It was priceless, I have to say. I felt very sick and very happy all at the same time.
I do think that we definitely owe Quincy Jones a big thank you. But one of my friends, I had a small situation. I'm sure lots of people had a small situation. One of my friends bet $1,000. And I thought he was kidding, right? Oh, he bet $1,000. So it all worked out. It was very fun. Fun time. Can't wait till next year. Who knows who's going to be involved. The best part about it was like the back and forth before, as we were trying to figure out if we were right. Someone sends a YouTube video of her previous performance in 91. And then someone sends a video of the fact that she's going to have someone signing along with her, so we know she can't get out of control. She's got to stay linked up with the person who's signing. I mean, it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun.
You're right. I had been doing some handicapping. Again, this is how sick I am. Before we got this inside info, I was handicapping the prop, and I found that 91 Gladys Knight version where she just belts it out and goes right through it. So my initial lean was, this is going to be the under. And Quincy was like, no, no, man, you got to realize that was 91. This is 2018. How many more big moments is she going to get on the stage in front of this many people? She's going to draw it out. And then he revealed about the inside info. It was pretty priceless all in all.
I think from now on this podcast, if you feel like you got a little bit luckier, you got the photo went your direction, the takedown went in your direction, the DQ or whatever it is, you need to tweet out whatever you need to say, and then hashtag brave, because it was the second brave that got us home.
apparently some places had rules where they specified the first Brave, but that makes no sense to me. I don't think in my life I've ever heard anybody sing Brave more than once. The rules that I read were through the end of the word Brave, which made it a clear over. But as always, with everything, you got to read the rules. And I'll also just throw a little note out there, JK, to any potential sponsors listening. If your sports book decides to come on board with the podcast, we won't talk about bets that you have to bet in these faraway offshore places anymore. Just so you know that. I just want to get that across. Let's talk about some racing, because the Super Bowl doesn't deserve much. Triple Crown action this weekend. With which performance were you the most impressed?
On the Fox broadcast, I think I said Mucho Gusto at first, and then I kind of regretted that right after I said it. I think Tax's performance was probably a little bit more impressive. The fact that he kind of stumbled early, showed some grit to kind of fight through that spot, the spot that might have been opened up for him a little bit, but he still ran right through there. Heady claim, obviously, by Danny Gargan and Randy Hill and the team there. Ran really well. I'm not cutting in line to bet futures on Tax, but it was an impressive performance. And I think that Mucho Gusto is the type of horse that, although he ran well, and although I think a lot of people expected him to run that way, that well, in that circumstances, you know, he ran on a sloppy track. There was a lot of info out that apparently his 2-year-old Breeze took place over a sloppy track. It was like everyone knew he was going to run well on the surface. And so he ran really well. Let's see what he does on a fast track. He's still no improbable to me. He's still no game winner to me. He's the third or fourth in that Baffert barn. Maybe fourth if you want to count the filly, Flor de Lamar. So let's see what happens. I said before, and I'll say it again. You can pay attention. You can soak it all in. But do not fall in love with horses on the Derby trail when you're thinking about what you're going to do the first Saturday in May.
A lot of stuff to unpack there. I'll start off with my thoughts on Tax. I do think that's a good point. We're not having this conversation if that hole doesn't open. That hole doesn't open if Relu Gutierrez isn't race riding the rival on the outside. It was a nice effort, 96 buyer speed figure, but I'm not ready to get super excited about from a Derby point of view, even though the figure was good and even though there was some adversity overcome and some grit shown. I agree with all that, but I'm just sort of taking as we do on so many of these horses, a wait-and-see approach going forward.
But here's the thing, Pete. One thing about Tax, just to keep in mind, we always talk about these broadcasts and some of the great notes you can get. Danny Gargan in the post-interview said that he actually thinks Tax is going to be better on the turf. So wherever you keep notes, pop that in there. When you see Tax show up after this Derby business is over and you see Tax show up on the turf, I think it's important to remember that Danny has predicted that the horse is even going to be better on the grass.
Both Tax and Mucho Gusto at 33-1 for the Derby. Either of those tickle your fancy, and then just to put your feet to the fire, pick one or the other.
Give me Tax, neither tickle my fancy, but that's the choice I would take.
You might have to turn in your silver wig for that response, JK.
Funny enough, we're getting closer to a real friendship between me and the silver-haired man. My mom and my son, who came along with, sat in Front Runner while I did the show. And they were sitting right next to Bob Baffert's table. When I got up there, you know, we joke about the situation with me and B-Squared being buddies. We've talked a few times. We don't have each other's cell phone numbers or anything like that. But I was very pleased that, like, he recognized me from our recent, you know, our other conversation in the past. And we talked for, like, 15 or 20 minutes. And I told him that I was really upset that when Joe took the horse back, I thought he should have been loose on the lead. And he essentially told me, like, that was the instructions he told Joe. He said, ride him like a good horse. And ride him to win the race. You know, those horses, he's better than the horses that were in that race. And there's no reason to go out there and run like that on the front end. Keep him clean and just keep him out of the way. It was nice to hear that information.
I'm not sure I fully understand that. Ride him like a good, what does that mean? Ride him like a good horse means rate him, or it means send him?
It means like ride him like a good horse, like keep him in behind and teach him a lesson. Ride him like a good horse. And no matter what the situation is, you're going to beat these other horses. So why go out there and drill him out there on the front end?
Yes.
And, you know, not know what's going on behind you. Just take him in there, sit him behind horses and let him run by him late. And that's kind of what he did. I was a little bit concerned that he invited Gunmetal Gray into the race around the 3/8 pole. And I thought that could have been dangerous. But when Joe asked, I mean, he just skipped over the ground and kind of pulled away.
He had so much. Absolutely. And I do think I'm more impressed. I take him going forward because of the fact that he showed that New Dimension. I felt like that was enough. Mucho Gusto earned a 90 buyer.
He's going to probably get on a plane, I would imagine, next. And Bob's kind of hinted at that Mucho Gusto will be the one that goes on the road. I would imagine improbable. And Game Winner will stick around. I did ask Bob a question that I think I'd like to share. I said, Game Winner's working, right? He said, yeah, he worked the other day. I worked him easy. I can get him ready like that. He just kind of expressed the fact that like getting Game Winner ready is not going to be a problem in terms of timing. I guess he's got enough of a foundation and they've kept him fit enough that it shouldn't take much to get him going in the right direction. So I would imagine that those two will stick around and try to kind of maybe battle out for who's going to run at Santa Anita. And Mucho Gusto will probably get on a plane. I could see Mucho Gusto going to New York. It's kind of what he did last year with Restoring Hope. He sent him to New York to run in some of the preps over there. I would imagine Game Winner Improbable, one of those horses would end up maybe at Oaklawn. It's kind of a Bob Baffert thing. He did it with American Pharoah, and he's done it with Bodemeister as well in the past. So maybe one of them ends up there, one in Santa Anita. No one's feeling sorry for Bob Baffert and the wealth of three-year-olds that he has.
Mucho Gusto earned a 90 buyer, so based on the figures, your opinion makes more sense than mine, but this is just the sense that I have. 33-1 from the Baffert barn versus 33-1 on tax. I'm going to just lean it a little bit the other way, but neither one are cut in line prices, at least not at the moment.
Let me tell you who I am not interested in, and that is the 1-2 finishers of the Holy Bull. When you get a 25-1 shot, and a 99-1 shot run in, it's usually not a great race. And I've been dying to say something out loud, and I can say it on these airwaves. I couldn't say it on the other ones. I almost jumped out of my chair when Harvey Wallbanger won. I cannot tell you how many times that horse has hung and beat me. Maybe 2 or 3 times we were alive for huge scores, and he couldn't get the job done. And then all of a sudden, when I don't need him, he comes barreling through the rail like he's Super Saver or something.
Well, it was a perfect setup. You look at the pace figures for the race, and he just ran perfectly evenly while the rest of the field ran incredibly inefficiently. This is the formula, or one of the formulas, to produce big long shots. The fastest horses in the race, the better horses in the race, run their race too early, inefficiently. You'll see those red fractions over on Timeform US that help indicate that. Meanwhile, he's just sort of going the one pace. But like the story of the tortoise and the hare, when they go way too fast early, that can get it done. Harvey Wallbanger earns an 85 buyer, more in line with an allowance race than a graded stakes. Good for him. Great story about the name. Actually, I'll link to that in the blog too. Not named after the drink, but after a famous racing buffalo. Read the story on inthemoneypodcast.com. It's pretty cool stuff. I'll also throw in a link to the drink, too. Not a drink for me, by the way. Sort of 1970s in a glass. Maybe something you'd order at the Regal Beagle. Galliano and orange juice, that's just too much of the same kind. The vodka doesn't quite do enough to redeem it for me, JK. But anyway, Everfast ends up second. You can make a case that he ran better than the leader. You can probably make a case that both Epic Dreamer and Maximus Mischief ran better than the leader from an ability standpoint just by being on or closer to that very fast pace. Do you want any of those horses out of this going forward?
None of them. I don't want any of them out of here. Not one of them. None of them. Not one. But I will say this. I think it's very important. If you happen to be one of those conspiracy theorist complainer guys, Irad and Jose do not let each other win. And this is absolute proof of it because they buried each other in this race. And if it wasn't for them riding each other's horses, Harvey might not have got through and Everfast might not have came running either. They buried each other. They are unbelievably competitive. You can find races where they've almost dropped one another. And the idea that like they're out here like setting it up for one another, I think is false. And this race is evidence of that.
Fair enough. All right. I think we're about ready to get to our guests. We're going to do that weird thing, JK, where you're going to go find a boutique coffee shop for 20 minutes while I talk to Pat. And then we're going to bring you back in to talk with Steve Bick. Anything else to say before we get to our guests?
Looking forward to seeing everybody in a couple of days here. And I'm really excited about listening to the little 5-minute interviews you've done. It should be a lot of fun. So make sure you check that out. It should be coming up pretty soon.
Absolutely. I have to work on that today. I've recorded a bunch. We'll try to get a bunch more and we'll do the best we can with that. Leading off with our very own Jonathan Kinchin. Okay, here we go with Pat Cummings. And now I'd like to welcome back to the show from the Thoroughbred Idea Foundation, the author of their latest white paper, Horse Racing and Quote Unquote Legal Sports Betting, Pat Cummings. Pat, how are you today?
Hi, Pete. Thanks for having me back on. It's great to be with you again.
I'm going to start off by referencing an old saw that I don't even know if is actually true, though you, as someone who's lived in Asia, maybe knows the reality of this a little bit more than I do. But I have heard the story that there is a Chinese character, pictograph, whatever you want to call it, that represents both crisis and opportunity. It comes to mind to me when I look at the issue of racing and legal sports betting. Is there anything to that?
Relative to the second part of your comment, yes. To the first part, I don't know. And in my 3 years of living in Asia, I resigned myself to the fact that I could probably pick up a little Cantonese, but I was never, ever going to write any of it. So
let me ask you about the title of the paper. Legal sports betting. I put the quote unquote around it when I said it to you, as you had to me earlier. Why, for the listeners who haven't yet read the white paper, and if you haven't, you really want to get on that. It'll be going out via my Twitter. Pat will tell you where else you can find it. But where does that idea come from that legal should be in quotes?
The thought is what legal really means. And for most people, when they think of the term legal, it means allow, that law permits this behavior, or it governs this behavior in some way, shape, or form. And Pete, all of that is true. It certainly does mean that and whatnot, but it means a lot more in the context of sports betting. And I think it's very keen for racing stakeholders to understand what legal sports betting really means in the context of horse racing. And we have a fantastic quote in the paper, and the raw paper itself, you can get it at racingthinktank.com. If you want to read it on the website, you can read it there. If you want to download a PDF, you can do the same. But we get the great insight from Maury Wolf, who every time I talk to Maury, I find myself having some situation, some story put in better perspective, because Maury just has a way of doing that. And when we talk to Maury about this, in particular, as a longtime professional bettor, both of horses and other sports, Maury basically hit the nail on the head with the story we wanted to tell. As Maury says it, and I'll just read the quote specifically, legal is not just simply allowed by law. Legal means infrastructure, strategic planning, investment in innovation, mobile delivery, customer service standards, marketing and advertising, lots of advertising. And importantly, it comes with the assuredness of being paid. That adds up to a lot. Those are the words of Maury Wolf. And so if you think that this general nationwide discussion following the Supreme Court's decision in May has gotten us to a point where, okay, you know, what has been kind of casual and illegal and maybe run in the neighborhood, or people that glom onto some online unregulated market to bet on sports, if you think that now that's suddenly just going to become allowed and it's okay, it's not. It's more than that. We're talking about full-fledged multi-billion dollar industry and all of the trappings of that, that will have an all-out assault on the consumer. And if you live in New Jersey, you experience that now. Someone recently mentioned to me somewhat casually that they believe that the early spend on marketing for sports betting in New Jersey in this one state of several million people has already exceeded that of some European countries where sports betting has been legal for a very long time. Yeah. And that's just, you know, what we're talking about, one state, one element. This is going to be overwhelming. And Americans don't feel that now for the most part, but they're going to in increasing numbers. It will infiltrate sports broadcast more and more and more as time goes by. It will be in every way, shape imaginable, a part of the sporting experience for the fan. That's a great thing if you own a sports franchise, if you are in any way, shape, or form compensated by sport, because more people are going to follow sport far more than they ever have. We quote in the paper the president of Turner, who I saw at the Consumer Electronics Show out in Las Vegas a couple weeks ago, basically said, if you have a bet on a sporting event, you are scientifically studied 80 to 90% more likely to watch and to watch for longer. And if that's the case, then all of the trappings of sport and sport broadcasts become more valuable.
That's right.
Gambling makes this more valuable. And the legal element of sports betting now will infiltrate, I dare to suggest, almost every facet of our lives as a consumer. Online, social, traditional broadcast, even traditional print where it still exists. It's going to be unavoidable. And tying it back into racing, this is the market in which our industry is going to have to compete. And that is where horsemen and bettors and everybody associated with this game, that's how they have to start thinking. The game has changed because the competition has just gotten so much more incredibly fierce.
Racing in the past, let me see if I'm summarizing this correctly, their response to other competitive gaming has been, okay, where's our piece? It seems to me what you're saying in these terms that are, they stop short of being an Orwellian level threat, but we're heading there. Seems to me like you feel that the, hey, where's my piece? It's cool as long as we get a taste argument is just not going to fly against this level of opponent, if you will.
Yeah, we would suggest that that's a path to even quicker destruction, Pete. The licensing situation, first off, is different in every state. Okay, so there may be some elements where horsemen are able to structure some sort of deal and quote-unquote get a cut. The money is just not there like it is from a slot revenue standpoint, and the licensing is expected to become so much more broader based that racetracks are likely to only be part, you know, one small kind of slice of this element. Horsemen anticipating that they're going to get a piece by simply getting some sort of revenue share, and this is just, it's unlikely. The whole situation has changed. If we go back to the mid-1990s, and funny enough, I mean, I wrote my senior thesis in undergraduate on the efficacy of slot machines at Pennsylvania racetracks.
Interesting.
Here we go 20 years later. The situation is very different. Horse racing was used basically as an acceptable excuse to allow casinos to flourish in America.
We were the way in. Right.
Exactly.
We were how they were they legal.
They were zoned areas where gambling was already acceptable. They took up a lot of space and were traditionally away from kind of the main center of certain areas, of urban centers. They weren't just in the heart of them. They kind of had their own little areas, and they were out on their own. And I do think of Pennsylvania quite a bit about this, because it was, you know, Pennsylvania was really a hotbed for this and this discussion. And 20 years ago, they were begging for them, and they got them about 6 years after the begging really kind of came into play. And a lot of people credit that to the Smarty Jones influence. But kind of separate to all of that, that now doesn't exist. That concern has been alleviated as casinos have grown beyond just the racino. The time and place where it was kind of like Atlantic City and Biloxi and Bossier, Shreveport, Reno, Vegas, and maybe some in the various tribal gaming areas, that's changed. It is much more acceptable, and people don't need racetracks anymore to gamble. So racing is not going to be in a position to simply claim a slice of anything in this new environment. And our response to that is, forget the slice claiming, compete in this market.
How do they do that? How do racetracks try to stand toe-to-toe and feature what many of us believe is a superior intellectual challenge and honestly an overall better gambling game? But what can we do to stand toe-to-toe with this new behemoth and come out with our heads held high?
Well, that's the thing, Pete. We know, we can speak completely anecdotally here, but there is a great degree of accomplishment in putting together a nice trifecta play or a super play or a pick three or a pick four. You know, there is some accomplishment to that fact, and that there is a feeling that a horse player gets in knowing that they've been able to put that combination together, turn a very handsome profit. That's a good feeling, and I don't think that's going to go away. It's a lot different than maybe saying getting it right in the Super Bowl, where you thought that the Rams would get less than two sacks on the Patriots. You say, well, you know, this is a toss of a coin. Well, most sports bets are tosses of the coin. And when you get a 50-50 prop right, okay, if you get maybe five of them right together, that feels pretty good. But it's a lot different than the horse race. What we need to consider, I think, is the method by which growth is happening. All of the growth in sports betting is fixed odds. Every sports-related bet that is being made in these new markets, in Jersey, in Pennsylvania, in Rhode Island, and everything that's going to come, the players are going to know what their end result is going to be, you know, at the moment they make their bet. They get to make a decision knowing this is what I'm going to get at the end. Right now, racing can't do that. That is one of the great flaws in the parimutuel system. It is a benefit in some respects, and I don't see a fixed odds replacement coming for trifectas or supers or pick fours or fives or sixes. And so racing still has an advantage in that capacity. All new generations going forward, new betting customers that will be aging into the market, are going to be confronted with a reality that is almost entirely fixed odds. And your existing customers who have been betting in the win pools and the exactas and the double pools parimutuelly, where they might have a better idea of what their return is, they are going to be courted with this tsunami of advertising and a tremendous wave of infrastructure and investment that's coming after them and saying, come play our fixed odds game. And if you're horse racing, if you are the groups who have to approve how your signal is being used and how your product is being delivered to the betting customers, you have to say, why am I not playing in this market? Why is my sport, why is my option not available to these customers who are pursuing fixed odds wagers? So our argument is, don't go for the slice, compete.
Let's talk about the specifics, and there's more to do on the whole notion of how we can compete, but the specifics of getting fixed odd betting, futures on the Kentucky Derby, anti-post markets for the Breeders' Cup, things like this that I believe not only create great gambling opportunities, but also make people much more invested in the gambling side and the sporting side. I think it's a very appealing notion. What has to happen for that to be legal?
You took two examples that are very unique, and we've heard the stories most recently in Mississippi, Johnny Avello, through the DraftKings Sportsbook down there in, I think it's D'Iberville, trying to offer a future book on the Derby and kind of getting shut down in doing so. But part of that was that the Mississippi casinos did not have a relationship with the Kentucky Horsemen, or certainly not Churchill Downs. And I can actually understand that, whereas in Nevada, through the Las Vegas Dissemination Corporation, there was a relationship, at least specific to the tote. I think the Breeders' Cup would happily be involved in some way, shape, or form in a fixed odds betting product. But take the biggest examples for a second, Pete, and just put those aside. The horsemen have a say in the distribution of their product. They have a vested interest in the sustainability of racing. The racetracks increasingly do not. When most of these racetracks have full-fledged casinos, and we address this in the paper, they have full-fledged casinos and poker rooms and table games. They're a casino. They are a full-service casino property, and racing is simply a part of this. For all intents and purposes, a very expensive part of kind of a greater picture. We believe that the horsemen need to take control as basically being the only people who are most concerned about the sustainability of their own product. So if the racetracks are fully operating casinos on their own, racing isn't as important to them as a sustainable path forward. the horsemen are the ones that need to be most concerned about that. And all of the various industries that trickle down from racing, the feed mills, the transport agencies, everything like that, the hay growers, those are the ones that need to be concerned about this. And it is the horsemen that are holding in their possession the rights to distribute their signals. And what our suggestion is, they're the ones that they're most concerned about the sustainability of this business. They need to be the one cutting deals to offer casinos, to offer the racetracks, to work with the racetracks, to come up with fixed odds wagers on racing. Will it happen is another story.
Yeah.
I would suggest in some respects that the horsemen aren't necessarily even thinking about this. We've seen little bits and pieces of it in New Jersey. And New Jersey is a very unique example. They're very far ahead of the curve. Monmouth is essentially owned by the horsemen. They have the William Hill Sportsbook, and they got a couple fixed odds bets on the Haskell approved. On Haskell Day at Monmouth, they handled over $21,000 on three fixed odds bets that had almost no advanced marketing, no advanced whatever you want to call it. There's basically, in this one small area of the racetrack, $21,000 was bet on fixed odds outcomes of one race. There were head-to-heads, which garnered the most. That was about $15,000, and then about $14,000, rather, and then about $4,000 each on margin of victory in the Haskell, and then there was a pick-three prop plus a baseball game. There were some limits on it. They put a cap on it. What I thought was interesting, Pete, is here is a product that's never been offered in horse racing in New Jersey, that is offered in this very small kind of back corner of Monmouth Park on one day, and it was handling more than some of the early exotic wagers, which were fully distributed across all of North America through all the ADWs on that Monmouth card.
It's pretty interesting, that's for sure. No discussion about how to compete can be complete without some talk about pricing. Horsemen sometimes seem to understand the importance of having competitive pricing. Other times they seem resistant to the idea of what I would call more competitive pricing. How important is that to making this plan work?
Well, an efficient sports betting market tends to be priced at roughly around that 5% mark. And not all of the states are going to get to that point just yet. It'll eventually get there. The key point for horsemen is to recognize that your current product, and we say this, I think, very clearly in the paper, the parimutuel model at roughly a blended 20% takeout antiquates quite quickly when all of the development, all of the infrastructure, all of the investment is being put behind a product that is exponentially cheaper than what you're offering. And everybody knows what their return is going to be when you place a bet. So if you don't want to talk about pricing on the parimutuel model, that's fine. You're just going to get run over. You're going to get steamrolled if racing does not find a way to compete within this marketplace that is where all of the growth is taking place right now. This would be the equivalent of filmmakers arguing over what percentage of cut to get off of tapes they sell to Blockbuster in 1998 and ignoring what the rights are for streaming. And it's coming down the pike a couple of years after that. If you spend all your time focusing on how you're going to pay Blockbuster, how Blockbuster is going to pay you, you missed all of the growth opportunity that was coming down the road.
That's a good metaphor, I think, as these discussions continue. One other way I feel like racing could compete, and I know this would involve a radical technological improvement, the kind of which racing has been hesitant to make in other situations. But I feel like if everybody could get a real-time feed in running betting through an exchange wagering type of an interface could be game-changing in an amazing way. I mean, it'll take people time to get up and running on it, but I think it could be a really exciting product that would attract new fans and give people something to bet on that they've never really seen before. But I don't think it works when everybody's looking at pictures from a different source. Some are ahead, some are behind. I think the technology would have to come first. Is that something that you're excited about that you could see being part of racing's future?
Without question, Pete. One of the random things we even offered is the suggestion that racetracks put up a camera at the half-mile pole and a photo finish camera, and they take fixed odds bets on who's leading after the first half mile or with a half mile to go.
That's pretty
basically
funny.
Every race becomes two. You don't pay off on prize money, but you don't get a win in your column in the NBA for whether or not you let it halftime. Same thing would apply here. This type of changes in the wagering landscape, all of these things are going to happen in sports betting. We have some very interesting insight from a fellow who works for a company called Swish Analytics, Bobby Scoff, who talks about how this is all going to be customer-driven going forward. Customers are going to want to bet on the equivalent of who's leading after the first six furlongs in a mile in a 16th race, or who's going to win based on what has happened, essentially in running wagering. The exchange offers a lot of opportunity for players to get involved. And I know the biggest players, you know, want to be incentivized for providing liquidity in those markets. And liquidity is always kind of the big concern. That's the player concern. The industry concern is the funding model. And I believe I've heard something to the effect of the funding out of an exchange wager. You basically need to make about 13 bets on average to make up for the equivalent of the takeout of one racing bet on the parimutuel system. And that scares a lot of people. That scares horsemen into thinking that the revenue stream isn't going to be the same. But you know what? That's where the future is. And if you're not embracing it now in this type of landscape, the prospect of in-running wagering or of increased opportunities on the same event beyond the traditional menu that exists now, you're not thinking right. You're thinking with a 1990s mindset in a sport and in a sporting landscape that has vastly, vastly changed. And you need to adapt to this kind of new way of thinking, or else that the fears for the sport and gambling on this sport are very real and very deserved.
Are tracks allowed to offer fixed odds on anything? I'm sorry, that's kind of an ignorant question, but just to give listeners a little bit of an overview. I mean, the photo finish camera at the half mile pole fixed odds idea is really interesting. Where could that happen anytime soon?
I think there's a lot of things for lawyers to discuss on these matters, and they will do plenty well in the next few years if racing gets itself together. But the general conversation that I've had has been that the Interstate Horse Racing Act actually enables racing to take cross-state bets on fixed odds wagers. It does not explicitly prohibit fixed odds wagers on horse racing, nor does it implicitly allow it either. It doesn't say only parimutuel wagering. It does specifically mention parimutuel, but it doesn't negate other potential wagers, so that the cross-state lines that apply, and that actually puts racing at a huge advantage over other sports right now, where you may only be able to traditionally operate in the Pennsylvania pool or the New Jersey pool from a fixed odds standpoint. You're limited to that, but horse racing should have an exemption based on several of the conversations I've had with those who are more knowledgeable about kind of those machinations than me. But then it comes down to what the individual gaming and or racing commissions permit. But let's think of this even simpler, Pete. Why are there no racetracks running in America at 10 or 11 a.m. on a Saturday morning?
That's a good question.
Why are there not people trying to take advantage of those opportunities and fill the markets? If you look into the future of sports betting, I think what we're going to see is a much greater separation of games and game times to spread out the starting points, to engage customers at kind of different points so that not all of the East Coast games are starting at 7 o'clock, for example, and that they're going to start spreading that out to engage the betting customer more. Why isn't racing doing the same? Why do all the East Coast tracks have to start between like 12:30 and 1? Why aren't people trying to take advantage of the availability of that capital that's out there and at least test the waters and see what can happen? I think there's an opportunity there for that, and it just kind of goes part and parcel with this observation of the marketplace and what opportunities really exist for customers, not just in the existing parimutuel pools, of course, but what could be going forward with various fixed odds opportunities.
I'm proud of the way I brought in this segment, because those are the two themes of this issue. there is crisis, there is opportunity. Hopefully the work you're doing in the white paper, in general over at the Thoroughbred Idea Foundation, can help spread the word. I'll close with one final question, a version of which I've asked you before. Listeners interested in helping, what can anybody, if anything, do to help spread this message and show that we support these efforts and really like the ideas that you're putting out there?
Pete, you and I are very engaged on social media, maybe not always on the same topics, but you know, we see the dialogue that's out there, and it's very clear that there are a lot of people who care. The problem is very little is actually going to get done on those platforms. A lot of it is just talking back and forth amongst the same people. You need to take this message to the streets. You need to take this message direct to the people who have the influence, who have the ability to do this. And behind closed doors, that's what we're doing. Okay, so as much as we're putting our reports out there, we're allowing the industry to digest it, we're taking it to the people directly. We're taking it to the stakeholders, to the horsemen's groups, having those conversations. Okay, we're trying to get laws changed in the state of New York on breakage. We're trying to get some jurisdictions to adopt Category 1 stewarding over Category 2. And with this, we're talking direct to the horsemen's groups. We want them to be ahead of this. We want to present our well-researched findings to them, discuss it with them. And I've already had a couple of those discussions just in the 3 days since we released this paper. If you have an opinion on this, if you feel strongly, it's one thing to talk about it on social media, but it's another to find the email of someone in a horseman's group, in your HBPA, in your THA, locally. Reach out to them, because those are the people that are really holding the future of this sport in their hands. I know a lot of people that listen to the program are gamblers. I'm a gambler too, Pete, but I love this sport and I want it to continue. And we need to be engaging those people who are in those positions of power to change the future. And that's where it's going to get done. It's not going to get done just bickering back and forth kind of in the social media sphere. It can be a little helpful, but we got to take it and have those direct relationships with people. And if you just try and do that randomly on your own, you might be surprised by how much people can engage with you.
Fantastic stuff, Pat. I really appreciate your coming on here and can't think of a better note to close off on than that.
Thanks, Pete.
Okay, now a segment I'm very excited for, bringing in a guy who has done so much for racing in his broadcast. Not just that, he's done a whole lot for the two guys also on this call. Bringing in now the shoe on the other foot, Steve Bick, as you make an appearance on the In the Money Players podcast. How are you, my friend?
I'm well. I appreciate you having me. It's a big thrill. I've thought about it for weeks, ever since you launched this thing.
You're a very kind man. I want to have you talk about the NHC coming up the end of this week. How long have you been going out there, and how important is this event to the broadcasting you do throughout the year?
This will be the fifth year. I was speculating on that today, but it's definitely the fifth, because John O'Neill was the first champion that we were there for, and then Paul Matisse, Ray Arsenault, and Chris Littlemore. So fifth. Basically, you and I were doing so much regular contest conversation that it just became sort of implicit that I at least go out and experience it. Right from the get-go, the sort of free-form broadcasting that went on, 6 hours plus on Saturday and Sunday, it was so well-received, and people said they had so much fun following the action that it was impossible not to follow up with it. So the year two, year three, and it's become part of a tradition. So it is one of the highlights of the broadcast year, going out to Vegas. It's become a thing.
It most definitely is. JK, I know you were particularly excited about having Steve on, and I'm sure you're going to have some questions for him here along the way. But you were telling me something off air before about why this visit meant so much to you.
Well, like a kid with divorced parents, I have my fathers together. This is at the same place at the same time. My first even stint in media was when I called into Steve's show as a listener just to try to like give my idea about how Bobby's kitten should run down the hill. And I thought I called in, Casey put me on hold, Steve brought me in, and I was ready to rock and roll, and I was excited, and I said it all, and then it ended up working out. So who would have known that that would have turned into this podcast and the fun other opportunities that I've had. So I just wanted to have a chance to thank my my racing media parents.
There you have it, Steve. You created this monster.
And no, you and I both. It's one of the great gags in all of in all of broadcast racing broadcast history that you and I somehow, you know. And I suppose we got to fold in Nick Tamara. There's so many people that helped unleash the power of JK.
They say success has many fathers. So does Jonathan Kinchin.
So well put.
JK, what else you have for Steve?
Steve, I just want to make sure that we're going to get a Marvin appearance this year on the show. Some of my favorite moments when you're out for the NHC is when you get the Matisse brothers over. And last year you were lucky enough to introduce the world to a figure that all three of us know very well, and the famous Marv the Bet Runner.
Marv the Bet Runner is one of those hidden gems that only a certain segment, a certain satellite core might encounter. And the Matisses are, they're radio gold, Jerry. It's quite remarkable. I mean, starting with Paul's win, and then that gave rise to, you know, the opportunity to have Paul and Duke together that year when Paul and Duke were both at the final table. The whole group has really been an invaluable exposure to the inner workings of serious professional gamblers to the wider horse racing community. Because the Matisses had a bit of a mystique, and obviously in Saratoga, you know, everyone knew them and knew them personally. The rest of the industry had some of these crazy notions that they were, you know, somehow something, you know, mystical, like some sort of the Masons, the like
or secret the, society.
Exactly. I mean, that they had some conniving, scheming methods to them, and some ridiculous suggestions. And the opportunity to kind of bring them out into the light and, you know, hear their understanding and have them offer their insight to more casual players and aspiring players has really been, I think, important. And Marvin, of course, is part of their whole atmosphere. It's a bit of a sitcom cast. And Marvin's like the Jonathan Winters character of any sitcom of the 70s and 80s.
JK, do you get that reference?
He said Jonathan. That's the only thing I knew. But I don't know who Jonathan Winters is. Tell you what, though. Marv is going to be a little upset this year. I've seen an email that Treasure Island is tightening the clamps on outside food on the ballroom
really?
Floor.
Really? Ooh. Yeah. Somebody told me that, and I told them they were wrong. I was like, no, we bring in outside food all the time. But I guess so that rumor is true, huh?
Marv's going to be very upset about that.
I don't know. I just see him in like an XXXL trench coat with the bags, you know, sort of stuffed into and around the garment. He'll figure out a way. He's resourceful. He's resourceful, that one. Steve, we definitely have to have you back at a later time to do some in-depth stuff on your background. This time we're going to keep it pretty narrow and just talk a little bit more about the contest experience and the broadcasting you do in that regard. Try to get people pumped up for next weekend. Do you have anything special planned as far as this year's NHC broadcast go, or will it be our usual super fun fire drill, grab everybody who's around and see what kind of stories we can get?
Much like any visit that I do out on location, it's pretty free form and pretty well served doing that, because the minute you start to try to lay a foundation and schedule things in, I find myself in trouble. I am much better off just letting it unfold. I do know that, you know, beside you being on hand and being there for the co-hosting duties, Rick Hammerly is coming on at least, I think, Thursday and Friday.
Great.
Rich Eng is going to be around for regular co-hosting and appearances. And from there, we'll just bring in a lot of former champions. Every time we get a chance to, you know, to bring in a Mr. Michael Bayciuk or a Mr. Stanley Bavlish, we love doing that and hearing from the living legends, the ones that they can find. There's a couple, I guess, that have kind of disappeared. We also, of course, are due for an extended Maven visit, and that is if he is able to hold himself together until Thursday or Friday, because he's been like a dervish online. I got to tell you, he's been like a maniac the last 10 days.
I spoke to him actually for this NHC special that's going to be coming out in short order after this show. That show is basically short interviews with a lot of the people competing, and he sounded like he was getting down to business. I'll put it that way. He definitely still had some strong opinions and a lot to say, but it seemed to me he was ready to channel his energy into this opportunity of a lifetime. Dave, of course, playing for $6 million in bonuses this weekend. Can't wait to see what happens there. General question for you, Steve, about the tournament world. Are you feeling still that this is one of the growth areas in racing? Do you feel like as much as we've progressed, there's still more ground to gain when it comes to contests and the overall sport of racing?
I think so. But I'm strictly going by what I hear from the active player community. And then what I hear on the back end from, you know, the organizers. So whether it's from the BC people, whether it's from the racetrack people, whether it's from NTRA, you know, listening to what everybody's pulse is for any, you know, for any certain moment, it does feel like there was a little bit of fishtailing that went on out of the BC issues the year before at Del Mar. There's the ongoing concerns that are voiced about the financial structure of particularly NHC itself, that it does have a bit of a cumbersome takeout structure, but the administration of an event like this, it has to be paid for. The people that are administering this kind of an event, they have to be paid for. I mean, it's not, I know that everybody seems to think that everyone should work for free. Everyone associated with racing is supposed to work for free to the benefit of everyone at large. I find that a very curious posture. So I think while people may grouse about some of the expenses that are taken off the top, the spirit of the contest, particularly NHC, remains very sacrosanct. The fact that you cannot buy in to get to the NHC makes it very special, and it still makes it, no matter what people, some of the players may complain about on their way to, you know, getting their seats, the difficulty factor and the exclusivity factor makes it that much more desirable and special when you get there and when you get through to the last day, when you get to the final table. I mean, the aura around the contest and around the room, and we've got that special experience to be able to relay to people how special it is when they get there. And then once they get there, no matter how they do, all they talk about is getting back.
That's right.
And that obviously is something that has grown organically. And it's to the industry's credit, to the NTRA's credit. And of course, you know, the origins of the contest, the DRF and everybody that was involved. This is a winner, and it has to be cultivated. It has to be, you know, pruned and tweaked at all times. But yes, this continues to be a great area of target and of player interest and goal setting. The live money side of it, that continues to grow and evolve. Look at what we just saw at Pegasus. 190 people, 190 entrants putting up 12,000 each. I mean, that says something. The Kentucky Derby betting challenge that Churchill kicked off, that continues to go well and grow. So there's a lot of things about the whole atmosphere that is working, but it does always need careful tending and careful administration to always work to make it better and make it as attractive as possible to the players that might be interested.
I'll piggyback one quick thought off what you were saying about the NHC and the cost structure. There's no bigger fan of the NHC than Paul Sherman. I think that's fair to say. He's had an incredible amount of success in the event. He has helped with the Players Committee. He's an NHC Hall of Famer. And even he says the NHC is not about the value. It's about the experience of the event. And that's just something I always like to underline. I call it the coolest horse player party of the year. It's fun to be there. Closest thing we have to a proper horse players convention, with no disrespect to EquestriaCon and the cool things that are happening with that event. It's still not the NHC. To be there competing against, hanging out with your peers, it's pretty special stuff. JK, I believe you had one more, and then we'll let Steve get on with his day.
Right. You mentioned experience, right? And it made me think of something. Is the two of you guys both are not, this is kind of a question for both of you. Neither of you are shy to get to the window. Do you ever get to the NHC, and as guys that don't really participate because of your role in racing, do you kind of wish like, man, this would be kind of fun. I wish I was playing today.
I would like to play, and my only real contest experience came in 2006 at the World Series when I was just getting involved with the show. John Parada had a pair of entries that had been traded for advertising for the radio show, and I ended up coming out to Vegas. First time I had been in Vegas in I might not even be exaggerating when I say 25 years. The last time I had been there was with Procter & Gamble when I was working on Folgers. And I had so much fun. Met Johnny D for the first time.
Nice.
And had a terrific 3 days. My first day I got blank. The second day I hit like four races. Then the third day I ended up 11th in day money and just missed a little prize. But I just had a riot. I started to play a little bit at that time because we weren't really talking contests on the show at that point. That's 2006, 2007. And I found it to be problematic because I found that it was affecting my regular weekday, weekend play. And I couldn't really compartmentalize. There wasn't as much of the live money out there at that time. I can't believe it's 12 years ago, but I really wasn't comfortable. I found myself sort of rethinking everything about how I was approaching. And that's why so often Pete and I, Pete, you and I would talk strategy, because I always found that it was not easy to break away from the thought process of your ticket building and bankroll management to get into the game theory of the contests. And I struggled with that. And when it started to impact my regular play, I stopped playing the contest at that point. But then not too long after, we were doing it, from an observation point and doing the punditry on it. So I didn't think it was even appropriate that I play. But sure, I absolutely would love to dive in at some point. And I should probably play some more of the cash. Certainly, there's no reason not to play some cash contests.
My answer is basically the same. I had a similar issue messing around with Mythical Money tournaments. The mental jujitsu got to be a little bit much. And in my role as a pundit, even though I can technically now play, it just doesn't feel quite right. But there is definitely part of me, JK, seeing the people cheering when a long shot wins and the excitement in the ballroom. It would be really fun to be a part of that. But for now, I'll just settle for vicariously rooting friends in. And because of this podcast and because of being on Steve's show all the time, which we haven't plugged properly, by the way. That's my fault. At the Races, which you can find on Sirius XM, and you can also find live streams and archives on stevebick.com. I feel like I know so many people, I'll just enjoy getting the vicarious thrill through them, and that's good enough for me, at least for now. And Steve, just want to thank you so much for taking the time out, coming on today. When can people tune in and check out this coverage next weekend?
Well, we'll do the regular Monday through Friday shows on Thursday and Friday. Obviously, I get there Wednesday night. So the usual 9 to noon at the Races. Then on Friday, the coverage we've typically started at about between 2 and 2:30, basically, on the afternoons. And we've gone until about 7, 7:30 Eastern time on Friday. We go a little bit later on Saturday. And then for the championship for Sunday, final table, we go, I think, till about 8:30. So it's anywhere from 5 to 7 hours of coverage those 3 days, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And then I'll stay in Vegas for Sunday night and do a Monday recap show. You know, by the time we get done Sunday, you can't really leave. So, and I'm going to New Orleans anyway for RZA Star Week.
Nice.
So I'll spend one more day in Vegas before heading to New Orleans.
Do you ever sleep, Steve? This schedule is insane. There's no rest at all.
No, I'm not a big guy. I'm a modest sleeper, and I actually Tina's had just about enough of me. I've been home since the second week in December, and so 8 weeks is about as long as any married couple should stay together straight. I don't recommend much longer than that. I know, who's it, Paul McCartney and Linda McCartney? They've never spent more than one night apart in their whole marriage. God bless them. I don't know how they do it.
It's time for those boot heels to be wandering, it sounds like, and they'll be wandering out Las Vegas way. Steve, absolute last thing. People can listen to these broadcasts on Sirius XM and internet, or is some of it internet only? Where can folks find the show?
It typically just go to the website, and just off the stream, it says listen live, the live link, stevebick.com, and just got a robust service for streaming, and because it's tough. The last thing I would want to do with Sirius, we did it on Sirius the first year, but the problem is they'll give me a set of hours. What are we going to do on Sunday when they cut us off at 7 o'clock and the contest is still going? So I just, in terms of the non-radio show broadcasting, just right on the stream, click on the listen link, and you can tune in, and you can do it. You can do it on your phone. You can do it on your laptop, whatever it is. Easy to just listen right from the website.
And if you're a player who's competing thinking, oh, I'd like to listen to that, good news, you can.
They do it all the time.
A lot of people listen in the subsequent weeks. You can just go to the archive. stevebick.com is the website. Steve Bick is the man, and I mean that in all senses. Appreciate your time today, sir, and look forward to working with you again soon.
Well, I appreciate it and can't wait to have you there, because I can get up and walk away, and I know that you will carry the torch. It's like the Olympic flame being tromped through the countryside. I just hand it off to Pete, and of course we're all just there to root Jonathan home. This is all an elaborate scheme to publicize Jonathan. That's all we care about.
Oh, you're so kind, guys. You're so kind.
And with that, we're gonna wrap up this loaded edition of the In the Money Players Podcast. Remember, special edition coming in the next day or two, the proper NHC preview show. For now, I'd like to thank Pat Cummings. I'd like to thank Steve Bick. Would love to thank Jonathan Kinchin. Most of all, I want to thank all of you, the listeners. And I'm going to throw in another thank you to the first two sponsors to come on board for this In the Money Players Podcast ride. Thanks so much to our friends at the Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation and 10 Strike Racing. We will be back sooner than you think. I'm Peter Thomas Fornital. May you win all your photos.
By the way, I taped the show. I taped the Fox Sports show, but I haven't had a chance to watch it yet. But maybe that's what I'll do now. That's why I haven't said how wonderful you were, even though I know you were.
For some reason, I don't know why I was nervous like the first 10 minutes. I had the IFB in my ear. People are yelling, Greg, you're on in 3 hours. And it was just throwing me off. And then I kind of settled in a little bit and it worked out. I ended the show with a 20-1 winner.
JK, I've heard about enough of your champagne problems. Oh, the IFB. I don't need to hear it, man. And definitely the most fun part of the whole show, and as great a job as not just JK did, but the whole broadcast team over there at Fox Sports. My highlight was watching him try to be humble, Steve, when they came back on the air after that 20-1 shot won.